Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. It's October 12th, and we're going to finish endocrine's system today. Just got a couple things to talk about, reviewed maybe just a little bit, and then move on to the introductory chapter to nervous system. But it's also a noteworthy day because what is 1 week from today? Yeah, lecture exam. So don't forget the lecture exam. And then the week after that, the third practicum starts. So the practicums won't be next week, but you do have a lecture exam 1 week from today. And let's see, this chapter and introductory chapter to nervous system will be on the test along with all the muscle chapters. There are two muscle chapters. So that's what's on the test. And the study guides are in Blackboard, so if you get confused to where they are, just kind of snoop around or ask me and I'll show you where everything is. All right, so we're talking about, last time, the thyroid gland, right, which is in your neck, anterior neck, kind of surrounds your windpipe, which we call the trachea. And the thyroid gland is actually a complex. Okay, you guys, who's horsing around back there? Okay, hold on, some people might want to actually kind of review this information. So hold on, unless you got a question, go ahead, raise your hand. I look up every once in a while. All right, so here's the thyroid gland. It's a complex of glands. The thyroid gland proper secretes thyroid hormone, which regulates metabolism. But also within the thyroid gland, there are some other glandular tissues that release calcitonin. And the job of calcitonin is to decrease blood concentration of calcium when it gets too high. And so one of the jobs of calcitonin is to help the deposition of calcium into bone, so it helps bone growth. As long as you have other factors like thyroid hormone and growth hormone and maybe even some testosterone will help that process. But calcitonin is most responsible for decreasing blood calcium concentration. Right? Also within the thyroid gland, there are the parathyroid glands. And we can see four of these little nodules on the posterior side of the thyroid gland. And they're antagonistic, right? They secrete a hormone that's antagonistic to calcitonin, and that is parathyroid hormone. So parathyroid hormone does what? It increases blood calcium at the expense of what organs? At the expense of bones, right? It can demineralize bones. So here we see antagonistic control of an important parameter, namely blood calcium levels by calcitonin and parathyroid hormone. And when both of those hormones are working properly, then you have precise control and balance over blood calcium levels, which is very important for all nerves and all muscles in your body. Oh, you can't see that slide, sorry. Let me slide it over. So here's that thyroid gland. Within the thyroid gland, there are cells that secrete calcitonin. And then here are the parathyroid glands in the posterior part of the thyroid that secrete parathyroid hormone. But what's the important concept here? The anatomy, of course, is real important, but the concept of antagonism. So how you have to have these two hormones working against each other to have proper balance. Okay, so that's going to lead us to another organ that is part exocrine and part endocrine, and that is the pancreas. All right, so what do I mean when I say part exocrine? What kind of gland is an exocrine gland? It has a duct, right? So it produces some kind of compound that has to travel to a duct to get to its site of action. And the pancreas is also part endocrine gland, which means what? It's ductless. And so how does the product of an endocrine gland travel through the body? Via the circulatory system, right? So it's picked up by a capillary, delivered throughout the whole body. It exits the circulatory system via another capillary, and then it binds to a target tissue if that target tissue has a receptor, and then when it binds to a receptor, it changes the physiology of that cell. It produces some kind of specific response. Okay, so the pancreas, the exocrine cells are what we call acinar cells. They secrete digestive enzymes. And so it's probably a good thing that these digestive enzymes have to take a tube to get to the digestive tract, otherwise these enzymes would digest the pancreas away themselves, right? So that's the exocrine part. The endocrine part of the pancreas looks something like this right here. So here is the pancreas. It's in the superior left abdominal compartment, and you can see that there are like little alveoli lined with various kinds of cells, and there's two important kinds of cells in the pancreas that we're going to learn about, alpha cells and beta cells, and they might have a little bit different color, I'm not quite sure, but this is not an exam figure, it's not anything you have to label. You should just know that these cells, okay, right here, are like interstitial cells, so we call these the pancreatic islet cells, they're like little islands floating in the pancreas. And they secrete two different hormones. Both of these hormones will regulate blood glucose levels. All right, so what would be your guess? What would be the action of these two different hormones, glucagon and insulin, being one secreted by alpha cells, the other by the beta cells? Think of calcium metabolism, calcium regulation. These should be antagonistic to each other, and you're probably very familiar with let me turn some of those lights down. You're probably really familiar with insulin as being an important hormone regulating blood glucose levels. Maybe you have not heard of glucagon. All right, but for instance, if insulin, who has an idea of when, what kind of disease does somebody have? What's the name of the disease that somebody has when their body stops producing insulin? It's called diabetes mellitus, and it's a very prevalent disease process, all right? And when does somebody have to take insulin? When your blood sugar is too high, right? So insulin decreases blood sugar by allowing sugar to enter all the cells in your body. So insulin is like a passport that allows glucose to enter your cells, and it's a major fuel molecule. So without your body producing insulin, right, all your cells are basically starving to death. So that's a terrible circumstance when that happens. So after a meal, typically somebody that's a diabetic might give themselves a shot of insulin, and then glucose can enter cells and it can be used to make ATP. Right? And when it enters a cell, what happens to blood glucose levels when glucose leaves the blood to go into cells when insulin is present? It goes back down to a normal level, right? So that's the beauty of insulin. All right, so insulin lowers blood glucose levels. So now you can probably guess, since we said that the action of insulin and glucagon are antagonistic, what is the action of glucagon? It increases blood glucose levels. For instance, when you're in a fasted state in a normal individual, when you wake up in the morning, you haven't eaten anything for hours, 8 hours, 10 hours, on a really good night, 20 hours, okay? So your blood glucose is decreasing, but your body can't function with low blood glucose levels, so glucagon is secreted by what organ? The pancreas, just like insulin is secreted by the pancreas, and it goes to the liver, and there is a storage form of glucose, and glucagon then takes the glucose out of the liver, puts it in the blood, and so what happens to blood glucose levels when glucose leaves the liver and goes into the blood? It raises, right? It goes higher, right? So the action of glucagon and insulin are antagonistic to each other. When they're working properly, then your body can regulate glucose very effectively. So the alpha cells of the pancreas produce glucagon, the beta cells produce insulin. And I think that's the best picture that I have for you right here. Okay, alpha cells secrete glucagon, signals the liver to release glucose from the storage form of glucose in the liver, which is glycogen. And glycogen is very similar to starch. Starch is a glucose storage form that we find in plants. The storage form of glucose in animals, however, is what we call glycogen. It's just a little bit different form, but basically it's just thousands of glucose molecules all joined together. Okay, and then glucagon raises blood sugar. Insulin, on the other hand, promotes the storage of glucose as glycogen in the liver, and it's a passport signal that allows body cells to take up glucose from the blood. As a result, that lowers blood glucose levels. All right, so here's another endocrine system that operates very efficiently through antagonistic mechanisms. What are two other hormones that we talked about that operate through antagonistic mechanisms? Calcitonin and parathyroid hormone, and what do they regulate? Not blood glucose, but blood calcium levels, right? Okay. All right, thymus gland, located in the mediastinum, upper mediastinum, is an important immune organ. There are certain lymphocytes. Lymphocytes are cells that can attack bacteria or viruses or other kinds of cells that try to invade your body to try to take advantage of it. All right, so these are what we call T lymphocytes, and this T right here comes from the word thymus, the gland. So these T lymphocytes actually go to the thymus to become competent. That means to mature and to become activated. So without the thymus, then these T lymphocytes wouldn't be able to reach maturity. And a T lymphocyte, basically there are two major kinds of lymphocytes in your body. They're a white blood cell, and a T lymphocyte is a contact killer. So when a T lymphocyte bumps into a bacteria that it recognizes as being a foreign cell, it causes that bacterium to explode or to lyse. And so then when the bacteria lyses, explodes, then it can't be infectious for you anymore. All right, so that's the importance of these T lymphocytes that mature in the thymus. B lymphocytes is another kind, and they actually produce antibodies. Antibodies are a chemical compound that when the antibody bumps into a bacteria, it just grabs hold, and they can grab hold to another one and joins two bacteria together. And then those two bacteria can be complexed with another set of a couple bacteria, so it forms a big glob of bacteria all joined together, and then that whole glob lyses and is destroyed. So that's the difference between these different kinds of lymphocytes. But they're basically a kind of white blood cell, and a lymphocyte you actually had to identify in a practicum or in lab. It was the kind of cell, white blood cell, that was almost completely filled up with the nucleus, just one big, huge nucleus, very little cytoplasm in it. Okay. All right, so that takes us to gonads. Give me an example of a gonad. A gonad. I don't say your little brother. You want to say what? Like a testes, right, in males, or ovaries in females, right? And in the male, I don't know if I have any pictures in here. Let's see if I have any pictures. I don't. Maybe when we get to reproductive system, I'll have some pictures. Okay, but they're the main source of sex steroid hormones. And in the male, the sex steroid hormones, generally we call them androgens. The most important is going to be testosterone, right? And in the female, the sex steroids or hormones, we have two. There's estrogen and progesterone. We're going to look and see how these functions in the very last week of the class, but not in this particular chapter. There are some cells, there are tubes inside the testes that produce sperm. There are some cells that are outside the tubular system, what we call interstitial cells, and these are the ones that secrete testosterone. All right, so in general, what is testosterone good for? It promotes the formation of sperm. Sperm is a male gamete. Right, and remember, sperm has to join with an egg via the process of fertilization to form a new individual. Right, so testosterone helps in spermatogenesis, but it also maintains secondary sex characteristics. What are some secondary sex characteristics? I don't have on this list right here, but what are some differences you see between men and women, typically? Voice. Men have a deeper voice because their larynx typically is a little bit bigger, right? The Adam's apple is bigger than men, so that produces a deeper voice. A little bit more musculature, more muscle mass. It's easier to develop skeletal muscle mass with testosterone as opposed to estrogen. Okay, coarse hair over your body compared to females and in more locations, and bigger, stronger bones. So those are typically some male secondary sex characteristics. All right, in the female, the ovaries produce estrogen, and estrogen maintains female secondary sex characteristics like what? Like breast tissue, right? Thinner, softer skin, right? Less coarse hair. And progesterone is the second hormone, and it prepares the uterus for pregnancy and is actually a signal that the female is pregnant, right? And this is just a foreshadow of the chapter that comes at the end of the class. What is that period of time when somebody is pregnant called? Or what's the name of the process? Gestation, that's right. And you see that word in this hormone right here, progesterone. Do you see gestation in there at all? And exactly this is what it means. It should really read, what? Progestational hormone. So this is the hormone that's necessary to maintain gestation. So this hormone is high during gestation, but if pregnancy is not taking place, then you would expect progesterone levels to be low. Okay, so that's it for the endocrine chapter. So there aren't too many exam figures in here, but this one is. So know some locations of a few of these different endocrine glands. Probably know some hormones and also a few of the end of chapter questions that are in the study guide. All right? And I don't have any online questions for you. Just the end of chapter questions, and then check your concepts questions. All right, so that's it for the endocrine chapter. So then, let's move on to nervous system. And everybody's really interested in the nervous system, typically, and that's a good thing, because it's a pretty exciting organ system. But typically, this is probably one of the more challenging chapters in the class. Maybe not the introduction chapter, maybe it's chapter 13, which is the central nervous system. So I just want to point that out to you and just be aware that maybe you'll have to spend just a little bit more time in this particular chapter, okay, compared to others. And that's because I think the bones you're kind of familiar with. Like if I show you a skull, you're used to looking at people's heads. So you know something about like cheekbones and jawbone and stuff like that. You're familiar with that. But for instance, when you start looking at a brain, it's a very amorphous kind of structure. And you've probably never looked at anybody's brain before. So it looks a lot different on the inside. All right, so I don't have the pictures handy. Let's see if I can find these pictures. Okay. So here is kind of a nice overview of the nervous system. All right, so let's contrast this with the endocrine system since we just got done talking about endocrine system. Endocrine system sends signals. What's the form of a signal that is sent by the endocrine system? A chemical signal that we call a hormone. And how does it travel around the body? Through the circulatory system, right? So it might take a minute or two for one signal to get from one part of the body to another. And then it's got to bind to a receptor and it's got to change the physiology of that cell, which takes more time. So the endocrine system is relatively slow. But the trade-off to that is that it has a long-lasting effect. So endocrine system is good if you don't need to change something in your body rapidly, but if you need to control something over the long term, it's very important. The nervous system, on the other hand, that we see right here, uses neurons, special neurons, and neurons can transmit information electrically very quickly over long distances in the body. So it doesn't take long for the nervous system to control and coordinate your body, but the duration of that control, unlike the endocrine system, is very short. Remember, for the endocrine system, it's long-lasting, but for the nervous system, it is fast, but only short-term. And so here is the general architecture. We have nerves out in the periphery of your body, like your arms and up in your face. Right, and then we have nerves in what we call the central nervous system. The central nervous system is the brain and the spinal cord. So in order for you to perceive your environment, you need to have receptors for some particular modality of energy. And in this particular case, we have a nice eyeball right here. So what kind of receptors are in the eye? What kind of energy can your eye detect? How about temperature? No. Pressure? No, not really, okay? But light energy, right? So there are photoreceptors, and then it converts that light energy into electrical signals that zip very fast down this neuron right here into the central nervous system. And the central nervous system then makes sense of what the signals are that the retina is sending to the brain, right? So you should be able to tell, right, as long as you've grown up pretty much normally, whether you can see different colors, right? If you're looking at something, you can tell if there's letters or if it's some kind of abstract drawing or whatever. So the central nervous system makes sense of patterns and colors to make sense of your world, and we call that integration. And depending then on what the brain perceives, for instance, then it can send signals back out into the peripheral nervous system to control muscles. And in this particular case, what can you tell me about this individual brain right here? What is it feeling? What's it looking at? Yes, a glass of water, that's good. I'm glad you didn't say something else, like margarita or something. But yeah, it looks like a glass of water right there. Okay, so this individual is what? Obviously, this individual is thirsty, right? So the integration center says, oh, I'm thirsty, I see a glass of water. Well, let's send some signals out to the skeletal muscle right here so I can drink that water, and then I'll no longer be thirsty. All right, so that's the job of the nervous system. It has sensory input neurons bringing information from the periphery to the central nervous system, which has the integration center. The integration center makes a decision on what to do with that information, and then it sends commands down to the skeletal muscles or it could be to the heart, or it could be to smooth muscle, or to other glands to control your body. And so here is kind of like a reflex loop, and it happens what, slow or fast? It's very fast compared to, say, the endocrine system. All right, another name for sensory is called afferent, starting with an A, afferent. So these are afferent nerves bringing information into the central nervous system. And then nerves that carry information out to the periphery are called efferent. So afferent is for sensory, exact same meaning, and efferent is for a motor neuron. Okay, so I see like a little blue color here, maybe a little beige and some gray in this area right here. That signifies peripheral nervous system, and central nervous system in this location right here. And I see three different nerves, and there's only one kind of nerve that is completely found only in the central nervous system. It's not labeled on here, and we should probably label that, right? You could call it an integration neuron, which is okay. But a better way of talking about that, this one right here is called an association neuron. Association neuron, or an interneuron, a neuron between an afferent and efferent neuron, is an interneuron, and that's the only kind of neuron that's completely contained within the central nervous system. And for central nervous system, I'll probably just keep saying CNS. Okay, CNS for central nervous system. And peripheral nervous system, guess what I want to say? PNS, right, just to save a little bit of time. Okay, so that's what I have on this slide right here. Basic divisions of the nervous system. You have sensory or afferent. This is for what? Input of signals to the CNS. You have association neurons or interneurons in the CNS for integration, making sense of information. Okay, and the integration center, in this example, we see it's only looking at light, but the integration center also will have other kinds of energies available to it, like maybe you're hearing stuff, and maybe you're smelling stuff, or tasting, or feeling temperature. All of that will be integrated at the same time for this brain right here to make a decision. Okay, so a good example of that would be, for instance, if there was a fire alarm going off, okay, in the class. A lot of the fire alarms have a little flashing white light. If you see that flashing white light, even if somebody is deaf, right, or has a hearing deficit, they know the fire alarm is on, and what would you do? What is this integration center going to tell these skeletal muscles to do if it sees a flashing light? Yeah, collect your belongings, proceed safely to the nearest clear exit, and safely exit the building, right? Blah, 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 blah. Okay, so that makes sense. Well, what happens if you're normally sighted and you're normally hearing individual? You hear the fire alarm and you see the flashing light. What does the integration center decide at that point? Exactly the same thing, right? Right. But what if preceding the fire alarm, there was an announcement that came over the loudspeaker system and said, hey, this is the fire department, and we're just going to do a test of the fire alarm system in the building. You don't need the exit. You see the flashing light, you hear the fire alarm. Now what's the decision that the integration center makes? Say, ah, give me that quiz, give me that test, I'm ready, I'm not going to leave the building, right? So it will integrate, the integration center takes all kinds of information, adds it together to make sense out of it. Okay. Now what happens if you see the flashing light and the alarm and the gentleman on the loudspeaker said, you know, this is just a test, you don't have to leave the building, but now you smell smoke and you see flames, what are you going to do? You're probably going to ignore the person, right? So the integration center takes into account all different kinds of information. All right, so don't forget, sensory is afferent, motor is efferent. The basic structural divisions of the nervous system. So this is some pretty good anatomy right here. You got central nervous system versus peripheral nervous system. Central nervous system is the brain and spinal cord. In the brain and spinal cord, we have pathways that we call tracts. And we have nuclei, and here is another name for nuclei. Nucleus could be used for a lot of different things, like the part of a cell that can that contains genetic information is the nucleus. But the nucleus is also the center part of an atom that contains protons and neutrons, if you've ever taken a chemistry class. Well, here's another meaning for nucleus. Nuclei is just plural. Right? It contains the cell bodies of neurons. It's a group of cell bodies someplace in the nervous system. And where is that place located? It's in the central nervous system. So it's a group of cell bodies in the central nervous someplace. Peripheral nervous system has nerves. Right? And a nerve, is we're going to see, is made up of axons. And it has cell bodies too, just like the central nervous system. Right, in the CNS it's called nuclei, but in the peripheral nervous system, a group of cell bodies is called a ganglion instead. So nucleus is particular to CNS, a ganglion is particular to the peripheral nervous system. So we're going to look at some of these shortly. It's just a little confusing at the moment because I can't say everything all at one time. So here is a pretty good illustration that I put into your lecture notes, which is very similar to I think the picture, that you have in your book. You have a couple pictures in your book that are close. All right, so here we see some structural divisions. We see brain and spinal cord. Brain and spinal cord make up what part of the nervous system? The CNS. And then here we have nerves, right? And then we also have some ganglia. Maybe you can see some little bulges right here along the way. And these are things that make up the peripheral nervous system. Some of these cells can be found partly in the central nervous system, partly in the peripheral nervous system, but there's only one kind of nerve that's found only in the CNS. Every little piece of it is in the CNS. Anybody remember what kind of neuron that was? Association neuron is found only in the central nervous. There's no piece that ever comes out into the peripheral nervous system. All right, so the nervous system main divisions that we see right here are CNS and PNS. Right, and the central nervous system is brain and spinal cord. And furthermore, maybe in parentheses you want to put down, in the central nervous system you have pathways for electrical information to take, and those are called tracts. And then the cell bodies of neurons, groups of cell bodies in the central nervous system, are what we call, one is called a nucleus, right? A group of them would be called a nuclei, okay? There's some old terminology when we get to it that's still floating around that you find in textbooks, probably including yours, but we'll cover that at the particular time. Peripheral nervous system, okay, over here on the other hand, pathways are called nerves, and cell bodies, groups of nerve cell bodies are not called nuclei, but they're called ganglia. So a tract is analogous to a nerve in the peripheral nervous system, and a nucleus is analogous to a ganglion in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so don't forget, we can break the peripheral nervous system down by function into two categories. Some nerves bring information into the CNS, and then other nerves take information away from the CNS to the periphery. Right? So from sensory organs to the central nervous system, we call those sensory or afferent division. Right? And then the kinds of nerves that take decisions from the integration center out to the periphery, we call motor or efferent. So CNS to the periphery, that's the efferent division. And if you think of a nerve, you did look at some nerves when we looked at histology, and at that time, maybe I mentioned how the electrical information travels in a neuron. Remember, a nervous tissue can be made up of two different kinds of cells, support cells and neurons. And what about the direction of signals through a neuron? What is the traffic like in a neuron? Is it a two-way street or a one-way street? It's a one-way street. Nerve impulses can only travel from dendrite to cell body down an axon, not the reverse way. So that's why you need to have two different nervous systems, whether it's sensory or motor, because the electrical signals are going in two different directions, so it requires two different kinds of cells to do that. All right, so let's consider the efferent division. Efferent, another name for efferent is what? Motor. Which way are signals moving? Efferent is from, say, your brain down your spinal cord out into the rest of your body. That it would be efferent or motor. And we can break motor nervous system down into two main categories. There is a somatic motor versus autonomic motor. Somatic motor means that it's going to go to skeletal muscle. And what kind of control is skeletal muscle under? Voluntary control, right? Your conscious thought controls skeletal muscles. Even if you're sleeping, your skeletal muscles can't contract because what are you doing? You're dreaming. Right? You might be running in your dream and your legs are going to move and things like that, but that's still kind of conscious control even though you're sleeping. All right, so somatic is almost synonymous with voluntary. Somatic means body. It means something other than a body cavity. And do you have any skeletal muscles and body cavities? Okay, you know, I can't really think of any skeletal muscles and body cavities. I can think of skeletal muscles attached to bones, which are, what, outside body cavities. So another way of thinking of somatic is outside of body cavities, outside the thoracic cavity, outside the abdominal cavity. And don't forget, we say CNS to skeletal muscle right here because it's what? It's a motor pathway. All right, so somatic and voluntary, as opposed to autonomic. Autonomic nervous system goes to things that you can't consciously control. Can you think of something that you can't consciously control? Like your heart? Okay, glands, sweat glands, tear glands, other kinds of glands, salivary glands. You can play little tricks, like right now I could bring in a guy with like 20 pizzas and what's going to happen? You're going to start salivating, but that's just kind of a little trick, right? You can't stop from salivating if I were to do that. For instance. Okay, so that's under autonomic control, which is not voluntary. We call that involuntary or visceral. And the way this visceral term came into being is because most of these organs are deep within body cavities. So they're considered viscera. So stomach is a visceral organ. Liver is a visceral organ. It's something that you don't have conscious control over. All right, so this slide that we're going over right now is going to take a number of lectures to actually cover, but this is just a nice overview and introduction. All right, so I would refer to this figure often over the next couple of weeks, just so that you have a good way of organizing all of this information. All right, the autonomic nervous system is broken down into two divisions, and these two divisions are going to be very similar to what you learned about calcitonin and parathyroid hormone. It's going to be similar to glucagon and insulin. And so what's the relationship between parathyroid hormone and calcitonin? Or glucagon and insulin, what are they? They're antagonistic to each other. But of course, just like the gas pedal and brake pedal in your car, that's a beautiful thing. So your nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, has developed along those same lines. So the sympathetic nervous system is what to the parasympathetic nervous system? You're going to see that they're antagonistic to each other. All right. So for instance, if one of these increases heart rate, the other is going to decrease heart rate. And indeed, the sympathetic nervous system increases heart rate and the parasympathetic decreases. And when these signals are mixed at the heart, then you have proper control, precise control and balance of your heart rate. So the autonomic nervous system, okay, goes to some other effector organs, right? Things that you don't have voluntary control over. Does the autonomic nervous system go to skeletal muscle, for instance? Nice trick question. You would say no, because the somatic nervous system goes to skeletal muscle because it's voluntary. So skeletal muscle is the effector organ of the somatic nervous system, and the effector organs of the autonomic nervous system are things you don't consciously control, namely smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands in your body. All right, so the only thing that's under voluntary control of everything that makes up your body is only skeletal muscle. Everything else is under autonomic control, and you, in your way of thinking, you can substitute autonomic for automatic, right? Something you don't have to consciously control. Okay. All right, so I think we talked about information processing already. In order for you to perceive something in your environment, what do you have to have? In order for, yeah, you have to have a receptor, right? So in order to feel hot or cold, you need to have a thermal receptor that can sense cold. In order to perceive light, you need photoreceptors. In order to sense tissue damage, you need to have pain receptors or nociceptors in different parts of your body. And is that a good thing, to have pain receptors in your body? Yeah, because when you feel pain, what do? Well, then you withdraw your body from that damaging, painful stimulus, and that decreases the amount of damage that your body experiences. So those are all good things. All right, so you need that sensory or afferent input travels from the point of somatic reception on the surface of your body, right, to a point of visceral reception in the CNS. So your brain is a visceral organ, is deep inside your body. As a matter of fact, it's in a cavity. What cavity is the central nervous system in? It is the brain is in the cranial cavity. But what's another part of the central nervous system? Spinal cord is another part. What cavity is that in? That's in the vertebral cavity. And if you take cranial cavity and vertebral cavity together, what's that? That's the dorsal cavity. Yeah, so that's kind of what I was thinking, dorsal cavity. All right, then that information is integrated, it's all added up together, and the CNS then decides on what kind of proper response is, right? And then that response sends signals out the motor division to somatic effector organs or visceral effector organs. And could you give me an example of a somatic effector organ? How about a specific name? Specific name of a somatic effector organ. And you know what my next question is going to be? I'm going to want to know an antagonist to that one. Okay, so what's an effector organ for the somatic motor system? Okay, give me a specific name. Specific name. Okay, I'll give you one. Biceps brachii. What's a biceps brachii? Skeletal muscle, voluntary. All right, what did I say my next question, follow-up question is going to be? What's antagonistic to the biceps brachii? Triceps brachii. All right, those are all somatic effector organs. All right, visceral effector organs would be like your heart, smooth muscle, and glands throughout your body. And there's sometimes antagonism built into these things, but in the somatic motor system, you have antagonism built in because you have opposite body compartments and antagonistic muscles, so you don't really need to have antagonistic nervous input, but for these organs right here, since you only have one heart, that's why you need both the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, right, to maintain that antagonistic control. All right, so let's look at nervous tissue. Let's look at some of the details of nervous tissue, and there are two kinds of cells in the body, okay? There are support cells, and there are neurons. So what do we have right here? Neurons. Or nerve cells, right? These are typically non-dividing cells. They don't undergo mitosis. Let's get a picture of a neuron here someplace. Ah, here's a good picture. So here is the neuron. I'm circling the neuron right here, and we have a nice micrograph of one, and it's stained. You can kind of see it, and it's got a bunch of processes or projections coming off. The central mass of a neuron right here is called the soma, or the cell body. So again, soma means typically body. So let's go to the illustration. And in the cell body, you have the nucleus and the nucleolus. Remember, the nucleolus is the active part of the nucleus. This is where transcription is taking place. And you got a bunch of other organelles in here, a lot of mitochondria, because neurons are very active, sending electrical signals all over the place. So it needs a lot of ATP. And there's endoplasmic reticulum, because it's got to make substances like neurotransmitters. All right. So the structural parts of this neuron right here, we see some very short, highly branched projections coming off the cell body. And then here is one really long projection, and it's not very highly branched at all. These short, highly branched ones are called dendrites. This single one that's very long and not very branched until you get down here to the end, this is called an axon. And of course, in between the two, you've got the cell body. And electrical signals always travel from dendrites through the cell body, down the axon, down to this axon terminal right here. And it's a one-way street. And you can see that because here is an arrow. And that's not a double-ended arrow. That's just a single-ended arrow. In order to understand why it's a one-way street, you got to take a physiology class. Okay? All right. So, but in this class, you should probably know that the receiving part of this neuron are the dendrites. It receives signals. It receives information from other neurons or receptors. And then it sends it to the cell body and then to the axon, and then it zips down the axon to this axon terminus right here. So it never goes backwards. And since a neuron is a one-way street, that's why you need to have two neurons. For instance, if you want information to travel from the CNS to the periphery or from the periphery back into the CNS, you need two different cells to do that, because one cell can only carry information one way. Right, so this part right here, what does this kind of remind you of? Think of a kitchen utensil. What does this kind of remind you of right here? It's called the axon hillock. What does that remind you? Oh, even you guys, stay out of the kitchen, okay? Go into the garage. You might find one of these things in your garage too. It looks like what? A funnel, right? Maybe you want to put some oil in your crankcase and you don't want to get oil all over the engine, right? You use a funnel, which gets all kinds of spills from all over the place and directs it into some center location right here so it doesn't spill all over the place. And this axon hillock is pretty much doing the same thing in this neuron. It's doing what? It's collecting signals from all these dendrites in the cell body, and it's what? It's funneling them right into the axon right here. So that's a very important point. These Nissl bodies right here are important for making neurotransmitters, so there's a lot of protein synthesis taking place. All right, so this is a typical kind of neuron, and this neuron right here is what we call a multipolar neuron, because it has all of these dendrites and one long axon right here. We see another kind of cell. Not only do we see this one that's in gold, but I also see some that are kind of whitish or gray right over here. These are the support cells, and these are what we call Schwann cells. And the job of a Schwann cell is to wrap itself around an axon. And the chemical compound that a Schwann cell makes is called myelin, and it's a lipid. And lipids can't carry electrical information. It acts like insulation. So a Schwann cell is like putting insulation around a wire that you have around your house. And typically, I'm very fond of insulation, because if you were to plug in your toaster and the wires didn't have insulation on them, what would happen to you? Well, you'd get an electric shock, right? So this insulation is a way of keeping the electrical activity within the axon, right? But it also speeds up the rate of this impulse down an axon. So sometimes we call this a myelin sheath. Schwann cells make a myelin sheath. We see another term right here called neurolemma. Oh, here. Okay, so here are a number of axons, and they're being wrapped around by a cell that is making myelin. All right, so it has, I can't even find maybe a better picture. This one right here. All right, so here's a Schwann cell, and you can see it's surrounding an axon, and it wraps itself around, and what does it do? Wrap itself around again and again and again. Right, these inner layers contain myelin, so we call that the myelin sheath, that's the insulation. And as it's wrapping itself around, the outermost layer then contains the cytoplasm, because all the cytoplasm gets squeezed into this outer layer right here, and you can see the nucleus. And so sometimes this outer layer of a Schwann cell is what we call the neurolemma. Right, so neurolemma is what we found right here. Let's look at this slide. So the neurolemma is the outermost layer of that Schwann cell that contains cytoplasm. Now, are these Schwann cells continuous down the axon, or do you see breaks in between them? Yeah, there are little breaks between them, and they're really special, so they're given this name, node of Ranvier. All right, so we're going to talk about those sooner or later. And then down over here, we have the axon terminals. And if I were to blow this up, maybe in your textbook you can see it. But the very tips of the axons are, oh, guess what? I can see it as I make it bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay, so I see just a nice linear structure coming down, right? These terminal branches are a nice linear structure. But when you get to the tip, what do you see at the tip of these terminal branches? A little bulge. You see that little bulge right there? Right? So that's the axon terminal. And it's a special location. It's housing lots of vesicles, and those vesicles contain neurotransmitter. So when electrical signal reaches the axon terminus right here, it causes the release of that neurotransmitter. Those vesicles will move to the cell membrane and then be released so that they can travel to a nearby neuron and excite a nearby neuron, or maybe even inhibit that neuron. All right, so neurons have the ability to conduct electrical impulses, and which way does that happen? Which way does that happen? Which way do electrical impulses propagate? From where do they start? What's the receiving end of a neuron? The dendrite. Okay, so it starts at a dendrite, goes to cell body, and then down an axon. Okay, that's the direction. They're extremely long-lived, right? They do not divide, and they have a very high metabolic rate because it takes a lot of energy to control all those electrical signals. All right, so a neuron receives a stimulus, transmits action potential. So an action potential is that electrical activity that a neuron produces, and when an action potential moves down an axon, let's go this way. So when an action potential moves down an axon, we call that a nerve impulse. All right, so a nerve impulse is an action potential as it's moving down this axon right here. So we got some terminology in this chapter. All right, and this information only travels in one direction, right? Before the neuron can develop an action potential, it needs stimulation, right? So stimulus is picked up by a dendrite, which then causes electrical activity in the cell body, which then causes electrical activity in the axon, then finally down to the axon terminus. All right, let's look at some neurons by their shape. And by their shape, I want you to know what some of their activity is. So where do we have some neurons by shape? Your book used to have some pretty good diagrams, but now I think it's only in a table. Okay, so the diagram is a little bit small. I don't want to make it full scale because then I can't close the window or move it around. Okay, so we have three basic cell shapes right here, and the cells that we're interested in learning something about are this yellow or gold color. All right, so these are the neurons. I see one here, I see one here, okay, and then I see one right here. But I also see some of those lighter colored cells, but those are the support cells. All right, so I don't want to talk about those right at the moment. I want to talk about this one right here. So maybe I'm going to really zoom in. Let's see what happens if I zoom into this cell right here. All right, so here is a multipolar neuron. It's characterized by having many dendrites with a lot of bifurcations, a lot of complexity in these dendrites, a cell body, and one long axon. So remember, the dendrites are the receiving end. You could think of these, well, we don't have these probably around very much anymore, but I remember having TV sets with antenna on them. You could think of these are like antenna on a TV set receiving signals. And then that information flows into the single axon and it goes a really long distance. So this cell body right here might be on the order of maybe 100 micrometers or microns. That's a millionth of a centimeter. But this axon could be even a meter long, right? That's a very, very long projection. That's why electrical signals can go from your brain down to the tip of your toe in just a split second because the cell is that long. Okay, so this is multipolar. The function of a multipolar neuron will be interneurons are multipolar neurons because they're receiving, or integration neurons because they're receiving signals from a lot of different places. But this is also an example of a motor neuron, right? And that could be either a somatic motor or autonomic motor neuron. The cell body and dendrites are going to be in the central nervous system, and then the axon leaves the central nervous system, enters the peripheral nervous system, and innervates some effector organ someplace in the body. All right, so a multipolar will be typically a motor neuron. The next kind of neuron that we have right here, right, here is the cell body with the nucleus. Here is the dendrite. What's the job of a dendrite? To receive signals. And then it flows down the central process of the single process of the dendrite into the cell body and then down the axon. And I know this is the axon because I can see the axon terminals right here, these little swellings at the end of an axon. So since it has two main processes instead of hundreds of little dendrites, it's got like one big one, this is what we call a bipolar neuron, right? But nonetheless, it's a neuron. It sends action potentials, nerve impulses. Because it has these two processes, it's bipolar. And the function of bipolar, we don't have many of these in our body, but they're for special senses, like for smell and vision, okay, and hearing. So these are special sensory cells, and they're relatively short, okay. These are found only in the peripheral nervous system. There might be a couple exceptions to that, but bipolars are found only in the peripheral nervous system. And that takes us to our last kind of neuron that we have right here. And I see the cell body. And is the cell body myelinated? Is there myelin around the cell body? No. And on that bipolar neuron, it was not myelinated either, right? Only these processes are myelinated. So here is the cell body. There's a single process that comes out of the cell body, and then it bifurcates into these two long processes. This one right here is what we call the peripheral process because this is the part that goes way out to your body. The cell body right here is near the spinal cord. This peripheral process goes way out, for instance, into your arms or to your legs. And this is what we call what your periphery. And then here are this receptive endings. This could be an example of maybe a pain nerve ending right here. So if you damage or cut this nerve, that's going to send pain signals to the brain. So signals will be received and transmitted toward the central nervous system via this peripheral process. It's going to pass right by the cell body into this central process. And we call this the central process because now this part of the axon enters the central nervous system. Right? And then you have the axon terminals over here. Okay, so we call this the peripheral process. Why? What part of the body is it found in? It's in your periphery, like arms and legs or torso. And we call this the central process, not because it's centrally located on this neuron, because this is the process that actually enters the spinal cord. Right? And the spinal cord is what part of the nervous system? The central nervous system, right? And nerves in arms and legs are part of the peripheral nervous system, right? And I think that's what these different color-coded informations are right here, right? You can see the receiving end, the sending end, how it's not by central or peripheral nervous system. Okay. But what I said is definitely true. So those are the three kinds of neurons, right? You've got multipolar, bipolar, and unipolar. Sometimes they're called pseudo-unipolar. Oh, guess what? On this slide right here, you can see unipolar and pseudo-unipolar are really the same thing. But you should be able to recognize these, make sure you know their name. So that's part of the exam figures. And then you should also know the function, like motor, special senses, and then for unipolar, that would be a sensory neuron or afferent neuron. All right, the second kind of cell that we have in the nervous system is a support cell. So you got neurons, right? And generally speaking, what's the job of a neuron? What does it do? It receives information and sends electrical information very quickly, right? So it sends action potentials or nerve impulses. Support cells don't do that. They don't send action potentials or nerve impulses, but they just help the neurons do their job. And since they don't send information, they don't send electrical impulses, people weren't interested in them for decades or maybe even 100 years. Now we're beginning to know some important functions of these different kinds of support cells, and our nervous system can't function without them. They're very, very important. So now people are really interested in learning everything about support cells. Another name for a support cell is called a neuroglial cell or neuroglia cell as opposed to a neuron. So these are non-neuron or supporting cells that act to support, protect, nourish, and insulate neurons. And we can classify support cells depending on what part of the nervous system they're in, whether they're central or peripheral nervous system. We've got four kinds in the central nervous system, right, that we call neuroglia. Can you say neuroglia? Neuroglia, that might help you in spelling. And the four kinds of cells are astrocytes, microglia, ependymal, and oligodendrocytes. And you have a pretty good slide in your book that shows these different kinds of cells. Okay, so let me find where that is. Right here. No, that's only one. That's only one. Let's see, do I have a slide of all of them? Someplace. Oh, your book does, but I guess I don't have a picture of it. Okay, I'll take them just one at a time. Okay, so here, what kind of cell does this look like right here because of its color? Looks like a neuron, right? So this is a neuron. This is the one that transmits electrical information. So these are dendrites or axons. I don't quite see enough of the cell to know which is which right here, but for sure here is the cell body. What else do I see on this slide? I see a blood vessel, nice and red. In particular, this is a capillary, and capillaries are designed for exchange, so things can enter the circulatory system or things in blood can leave through a capillary. All right, so this is in the brain or central nervous system. And then I see this like cream-colored cell right here. But what color does it look like to you guys? Cream is good. Beige? Green. Who knows, huh? Okay, I'm not the only colorblind person, obviously, here. So this color cell right here is not a neuron because it's not gold-colored. So this is a neuroglia cell. And when people first saw this cell, it kind of reminded them of a star up in the sky with a bunch of sunlight coming out of it or starlight, different rays coming out of it. So it has a lot of projections. So they called it an astrocyte. So here's an astrocyte. It's got a lot of processes. And you can see some of the processes attached to an axon on this neuron right here. Okay. And other processes on that same cell, the same astrocyte, attached to a capillary. All right. And so the function of this cell is to take nutrients from the capillary, actively absorb it on this process, transport it through the cell directly to this neuron right here. So it's a special delivery system for important nutrients. All right. The other thing that it does is you can see all these processes are surrounding the capillary. It also forms something we call the blood-brain barrier. because there are many toxins that end up in the blood that are harmful to this neuron right here. And I could ask you what your favorite toxin is, but I don't want to put you on the spot, okay? But I suppose adult beverage or alcohol would be one of those things that's toxic to the nervous system. This blood-brain barrier helps prevent toxins that are in the blood from reaching the brain and then deteriorating the function of the brain, because you need proper function of the brain to stay alive, obviously. All right, so that's another function. Blood-brain, not only can it take necessary nutrients and deliver it directly to a neuron, but it can prevent harmful chemicals that are in the blood from reaching the brain. That's an important function. The other important functions of the brain is that even though we said that neurons don't undergo mitosis, they still do grow. These processes can grow and develop. Dendrites can grow and develop. They can also atrophy. They can regress. So there are trophic factors. There are chemicals secreted by astrocytes that can cause neurons to grow and develop new connections between cells. All right, so it's not necessarily the number of neurons that you have in your brain that provide for intelligence, right? It's the kinds of connections between cells. And when a brain is stimulated, right, these astrocytes then tell neurons to develop new connections between other neurons, and so that's just one way that brains can learn, by actually changing their structural connection between other neurons. So the structure of a brain actually changes as you're learning things, right? Which is kind of interesting in this class, because I'm sure the structure of your brain that you have, the brain that you have after you take a really rigorous class, like a physiology class or anatomy class, is a lot different compared to the structure of your brain before you take a class like that. So the structure of your brain actually has to change. And that change in structure is guided by these astrocytes right here. That's pretty important to know. Well, what was another thing? Glucose transport. Okay. Also, we're going to talk about this in just a little bit. A neuron will secrete a neurotransmitter, and sometimes these astrocytes help in the recycling of that neurotransmitter and deactivating it, and then giving it back to the neuron so that it can communicate once again with other kinds of neurons. All right, so it's involved with neurotransmitter regulation. So that's a job of an astrocyte. Now here, and we're talking central nervous system, so here I see two neurons, and I see a different kind of neuroglial cell. And this one right here is a microglia cell. And a microglia cell is very similar to a white blood cell, because it can crawl around through your central nervous system, it crawls around in your brain and spinal cord, and it looks for things that don't belong there. What could be some things that don't belong in your brain? Parasites, like bacteria, viruses, and maybe even brain tumors, okay? And if this microglia cell identifies it, then it can cause the death of that cell, and then it prevents that pathology from developing and taking over your brain. So these things have to be very effective, because your brain is very sensitive to any kind of infection. And you need to have a really nice, almost perfectly functioning brain to stay alive. So this microglia cell is an important immune cell. It's for immune response. So this is an exam figure, so I want you to be able to identify the cell by its shape, but also be able to tell me what its function is. So what's the function of this microglia cell? Immune response, right? Okay, another kind of microglia cell. There are fluid-filled cavities inside the brain that we're going to look at, and they're called ventricles. And the ventricles are lined with a cell. So this is just some kind of, here's the fluid-filled cavity, here's the brain proper that contains neurons. And again, this forms a little barrier so that if you have an infection in a ventricle, it doesn't have complete access to your neurons inside your cell right here. But this fluid is kind of special. It performs kind of a mechanical function. It performs a number of different functions, but a mechanical function is the following. Your brain doesn't have any muscles in it. Your brain doesn't have any bones holding it together. It's just very delicate neuronal tissue, all right, and it's pretty heavy. So what's a way, some physical way, that you can take something that's heavy and make it lighter? How about if we weigh you right now, okay, and then throw you in a swimming pool and weigh you in a swimming pool? Where are you going to weigh the same? Well, you'll be a lot lighter in the swimming pool because you'll be floating a little bit, right? So that's what the job of these ventricles are. It helps float the brain inside your cranial cavity so it's not quite so heavy, so it doesn't get squished. So these ependymal cells right here fill that cavity with fluid. It's called cerebrospinal fluid. Cerebrospinal fluid is made by these ependymal cells. Okay. And then lastly, right, here is a cell that forms a myelin sheath around axons within the central nervous system. And it looks a lot different than a Schwann cell. You see the myelin sheath. This is called an oligodendrocyte. So an oligodendrocyte has a number of different processes. It can form a myelin sheath not just around a single axon, but a multitude of axons. And this kind of cell right here is found only in the central nervous system. And this is the reason why, or mostly the reason why, nerves do not regenerate inside the central nervous system. Like if somebody has a spinal cord injury, the spinal cord does not regenerate because oligodendrocytes that are particular to the CNS secrete factors into the spinal cord and brain that prevent the growth of axons. All right, so that would be really nice to be able to figure out how to prevent them from doing that for somebody that has a spinal cord injury, but we haven't figured out how to do that. All right, so these cells in particular prevent regeneration in the central nervous system. The Schwann cells, on the other hand, in the peripheral nervous system actually promote nerve regeneration. And I think I'll talk about that in a little bit, not this time, maybe next time. So if you do damage a nerve in your arm or finger or face or whatever, maybe it might take a year or two, but nerves can regrow to that area and reinnervate it so that you have control and feeling in that part of your body. All right, so all of these cells that we looked at so far are in the central nervous system. They're the oligodendrocytes for myelin sheath formation, the ependymal cells for making cerebrospinal fluid, then microglia cells for immune response, and astrocytes for doing a whole bunch of things, making the blood-brain barrier, number one, for special delivery of nutrients like glucose to an axon, and telling how neurons should connect up with each other, how they form a network inside the brain. All right, so next time we're going to start with cells of the peripheral nervous system, and we kind of talked about that already, namely these Schwann cells right here. All right, so that's it for today. Don't forget, 1 week from today is a lecture test.
Are you not in your office tomorrow?
I am tomorrow. 10:30, I'll just be arriving in my office. Before then, I'll be in the anatomy study room on the third floor.
Okay, but you are in there.
I am in there tomorrow. Yeah.
That must have been a day and
night. I know. I was called out by my boss. Yeah. Hopefully there was a sign hanging. I didn't even have time to hang a sign.